tiny figure tattered and torn. Bearing a large placard that reads jazzy jokes, peppy patter, clammy cliches, honest, reliable, sober, industrious. Stay tuned, friends. You'll find that it's good, clean fun for all the family. Good, clean, healthful, invigorating fun for all of the family. And in addition to that, you'll find that occasionally the muscle tension will relax. And you'll find, perhaps, that richer, more healthful, more bountiful living will be yours. So stay tuned, friends. We'll be here till 1 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll be perfectly frank with you. I'm a little low tonight, you see, friends. The straw in the wind department. The straw in the wind department and the gale that sometimes blows. You read about this poor guy who was driving. This is the straw in the wind for tonight. This is our thought for tonight. This will carry you through some of those rougher, more rocky moments as you attempt to shoot the rapids later on before we hit the 1 o'clock spot. Did you read about this poor clown who was driving in Minnesota, I think, someplace? And he came to a stoplight, see? And he was driving home from school or someplace, from college, and he had a good long trip ahead of him. It was a weekend. And he came up to a stoplight and he tried to shift gears and his clutch had burned out. He couldn't go. And he found that the only thing he could do was to get this poor old Lizzie that he was driving in reverse. That the only way he could go was backwards. Kind of a symbolic delineation of mankind's plight right there in front of us. And so he got this baby in reverse. And he drove 54 miles. 54 miles in reverse. And three blocks from his home, after driving 54 miles in reverse, some wise guy Flatfoot came whipping up in a squad car and put the finger on this guy, and within 5 minutes, he was fined $35 for apparently reckless driving and action not befitting a motorist on the highways of the United States. But think of it for a moment. Here was a man who had accomplished a truly heroic task. Here was a man who had out-homered even... But you see, that is, there's no place for an odyssey in our world today. There's no place for real heroics in our world today. Have you ever driven even a block backwards? Have you ever driven even so much as 200 yards backwards? Can you imagine this man 54 miles backwards with this giant stiff neck, with the transmission grinding, and he arrives only to receive a ticket and a summons and $35. He broke 427 international backward driving records. But who cares in Minnesota? Who cares in our world today? You see, that's it. That's the way it's going. There's no place for the hero today. There's only place for mediocrity. There's only place for thousands of small people and no place for the large ones. Here was a man of tremendous stature, a giant among us. A giant among us. And what do? We pillory him. We apply the fagots. And the flame burns brightly. 54 miles in reverse. Oh, indeed, unsung motorist. Oh, indeed, hero of the 20th century mechanical age, we salute thee. 50 years before your time. 500 years after your time. There was a place next to Richard the Lionhearted for such as you. And there might be a place beside Buck Rogers for such as you. But in our time, in our time devoted to creeping meatballism. Oh, no. Oh, no, buddy. $35 in cost. And you better get that transmission fixed soon, Mac. Let joy reign unbridled. Let joy flow like a great, heavy, rich sea of syrup of some kind, preferably maple. You know, it's a very interesting thing, though. There is very little place today in the world for a hero of one kind or another, of any kind for that matter. And the type of hero that we do allow is usually the very conventional type of hero, the Mickey Mantle, who all he does really is get home runs. This merely means that he has great reflexes and a good sharp eye. But the hero is a man who moves into fields that are largely unknown and at great personal danger. He moves into fields which, in many instances, are fields that are almost nothing but a sort of morass of quicksand. And there's no place today for the hero in our world, rushing as it is towards whatever it's rushing toward. And that's kind of sad, because the hero, and I'm speaking in this case, of course, of the genuine Beowulfian type hero, the dragon slayer. By the way, do you remember that great cartoon? Did any of you see it? One of the greatest cartoons I've ever seen in my life was a delineation of a very fine little short story by Heywood Broun called The 51st Dragon. It was done by UPA, and it was the story of a hero. It was the story of a young man who was a knight back in the days when knights were in flower. And he was going to knight school, that's spelled with a K, and he was learning how to slay dragons. Now, of course, dragon slaying is purely a symbolic thing. Few of us ever slay dragons today. And when we do slay a dragon, usually we do so to great public censure rather than acclaim. But nevertheless, this particular knight was learning how to slay dragons. And he worked very hard at it. But he was kind of a wishy-washy knight. He was thin, and his hair was kind of thin. He meant well, but he was, you know, he was just kind of a nothing type knight. And then the day came for his graduation, and the old wizard who was in charge of the school gave him the magic word. And he said, wherever you go, whenever you battle a dragon, you use this magic word and you will be invincible. And that bucked him up considerably. And so he went out into the world. And sure enough, he killed his first dragon. And it was a great event. And he killed another one. And that was an even greater event. Until finally he became the Mickey Mantle of dragon slayers. He was the greatest dragon slayer who ever walked out on the field, bearing his shield and bearing his lance. And then one day somebody said to him, how is it that you're such a great dragon slayer? And he says, well, you see, I got this magic word. I got this magic word, see, and when things look tough, I whip out the old magic word and he's dead, boy. I get him in a gizzard. And the guy said, oh, come on, you don't believe that? That's nothing but nothing, buddy. Come on now, you're not superstitious. And so our little knight began to think about this, see? Began to think about it. Began to worry him. Sure enough, there he was out there on the field. A couple of days later, he was going to go after the 51st dragon. The 51st dragon. And he never came back. That was the day that he, you see? No one knows what happened to him. All they know is that he didn't come back. And there on the wall of the old baronial mansion is the shield of the great knight and all of his dragons. All of his dragons are there. Each one is marked on the escutcheon. Each one is marked clearly and plainly for all to see, for all generations to observe. But the 51st, well, that's too much. You see, the old magic word. The reason we're telling you this tonight is, friends, stay tuned, because very shortly tonight you will hear the magic word that will enable you to slay any dragon that pops up in your life. So you too, friend, can have an escutcheon. You too, friend, can have a baronial shield. So stay tuned for the magic word. Stay tuned. Stay tuned, and you'll pick up a few magic words before this night is out. You know, the belief in magic has not completely disappeared. Boy, it's with us all the time. It takes different forms throughout each convolution of our civilization, but it's certainly with us all the time. The magic. And I'm not necessarily referring to the magic word. I'm referring to the term, the generic term, magic. It's always with us. Like, for example, I was reading this automobile ad here a couple of days ago in the New Yorker magazine, of all places, and believe me, they are just as much involved, the New Yorker, that is, with the belief in magic as anyone who has ever waved a silver wand back and forth over a tiny clay pinprick doll. In this particular ad, it told about... Well, here's the way the thing was set up. I might as well tell you from the beginning. It showed this car, you see. Great, big, beautiful, shiny car, just covered with chrome. A perfect example of creeping meatballism. It had this pinpoint, a sort of tufted, three-tone, medieval tapestry-type upholstery, you know, that most of these cars have these days. And about six colors, great chrome stripes. It was kind of like a chrome-plated watermelon. And this great big thing was sitting there, right there in front of us, in about 16 different colors. It was a beautiful ad. It covered two pages in the New Yorker, which is a fabulous amount of advertising space. And there down at the bottom was the copy. And it said, you getting old? Things closing in on you, huh? Nothing but the abyss ahead, eh? Clear all that up. Go down to your Fig Newton 8 dealer and ask to drive the new Fig Newton Diner Shot Special. And all those problems will just, you know, just like that. And you'll be off on the wings of youth. You'll be off whistling and singing bits and snatches of old barracks ballads from your halcyon salad days. Oh, there's magic for you, buddy. There's magic for you right there in front of you. But you know the worst part of it. Wouldn't you love to see the ad, though, 6 weeks after the guy has bought this thing, see, this giant chrome-plated watermelon? And here it is. It's in a parking lot on 46th Street, see, just off 6th Avenue. And somebody has scrawled two obscene words on the left rear door with their finger, you see, in the dust. And some guy has come around to the back on the trunk and he's written, "Wash me." And you know those white walls? There's a small Airedale. There's a small Airedale. He's looking at the hubcap, see? And the parking lot attendant has left a cigar butt on the hood. Off on the wings of youth. Off on the wings of youth. And all those... The abyss, huh? Hot dog. Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, he's Barbaroo. How about some thumper, huh? Been there, too. You know, I'd like to have been there. I'd like to have been there sitting next to that oriental rug. A small mouse just listening to all this stuff. You know, that's a funny thing. That's one of the dreams of mankind. It goes all the way back to the very earliest dream that most of us have had. And that's to be someplace where we shouldn't be with no one knowing that we're there. You know, the old invisible man gimmick. And I could think about six things that I'd like to do if I were invisible. I will give you now 5 seconds to think of the first thing you would do if you were invisible, buddy. Charlie. Oh, come on now. The kids and the women and everybody are still up at this hour. You can't talk like that with people around. Think again now. Think a good, clean thought. That's better. That would fit into Reader's Digest pages. The cleanest thought I ever thought. You know, it's a special little box. A new feature. Cleanest thought I ever thought. Like the time I was sitting there and I thought I'd like to have some stuffed celery. Now, funny thing about it, I don't like stuffed celery, but it just crossed my mind. I'd like to have some stuffed celery. So, is it going to be okay out there? It's going to be okay. Huh? All right. You know, speaking of the oriental rug, how many of you can read the symbolism of the oriental rug? like this lady I saw sitting in the doctor's office, just sitting there, you know, and had this real expensive oriental rug in the waiting room, and she's sitting there looking at this oriental rug, and her eyes are following the yellow line. See, they have different colored lines. Some of them are red, some of them are yellow, some of them are green. You know, you've seen them, all the little squiggly lines. Well, if you follow the right one, you'd be surprised what comes out. Anyway, she followed the right one that day, and within 30 seconds, the vice squad was on the phone. She called them indignantly. This guy got 5 years, this doctor, and he was a perfectly innocent man, which shows you how the world is going. You can hardly stand still these days. You either go up or you go down, buddy. Which way are you going? I am too, you know? That's the funny part of it. I think most of us are. Once in a while, you see one of these guys shoot past upwards. But those are just flukes. Little straws in the wind. Little straws in the human gale. Like the time I fell madly in love once when I was 9 years old with Gail Storm. But you don't want to hear about that. That's a sordid story. It was very early in my career. I was sitting there in the Orpheum Theater in Hammond, Indiana. And, you know, they had these drawings in between the pictures where they drew for roller skates. And that's what I always came for, that and the Ken Maynard picture. And they always threw in this second picture, which we referred to as, one of them love pictures. You know? One of them love pictures. And so anyway, I'm sitting there, and this love picture came on, and I was sort of in a half torpor, sort of a half stupor, when all of a sudden this thing looked out, this Gail Storm looked right out at me. I wonder how she knew I was living in Hammond, Indiana. Anyway, she looked right out at me, and she pinned my shoulder blades to that thing I was sitting in, you know, the stuffed seat there with a gum on the bottom. And it changed the entire course of my life. I lost interest rapidly in Ken Maynard on roller skates. And from that day on, it was a downhill course. Look at me now. Sunday night opposite Steve Allen, Ed Sullivan, everybody else. I'm the cheapest Phil in the business. This is WOR New York. We have records. Gene Shepherd will be here till 1 o'clock tomorrow morning.
But oh, my darling, always I when your lips were closed to mine, and I saw the midnight sun.
Like I said, that changed the entire course of my career. And look at me now. Yeah, you want to hear the rest of this?
Really?
Well, okay. We got till 1 o'clock tomorrow morning. We might as well. You know, there is no place for heroes today. That's kind of a sad thing, but it's very true. But the day of the hero is a past and gone thing. And today, we think in terms of mass action. We think in terms of being part of a team. We think in terms of, you know, carrying the old ball over the goal line. One of the funniest things I've heard in years was actually that phrase used in a sales talk. One of these sales conferences that organizations have occasionally. I thought this was purely a thing that guys wrote in books to more or less kid the world of the salesman. But there I'm sitting. I was called in on a sales conference, not here at WOR, by the way, but a place out in the Midwest. I shall always remember it. And this salesman got up in front. He was the head salesman. And he said, "I'm expecting all of you guys to carry the ball over the goal line. I'm expecting all of you to get in there and put your shoulders to the wheel. We've got to get over the top. We've got to push right through and crash right into the end zone. And we'll all be right behind this great big sales push this year." And I sat there fascinated, picturing these short, squat, paunchy guys wearing their Paris garters, carrying the ball over the goal line and into the end zone. And somehow, it didn't gel, see. Somehow it didn't work. And today, the hero of the average novel is a guy like in the gray flannel suit. Did you read that? That's one of the world's worst pieces of writing, in case you're interested. But it is representative of the hero of today, you see. A man who is so anxious and eager to get on the team. That isn't flannel, that's Harris Tweed. To get on the team. And he finally makes it, sort of, in the end, you see. To get on the old team and carry the old ball over the old goal line. This is not like the heroes of old. Did you read the thing in the New York Times here a couple of weeks ago about Frank Merriwell? Frank Merriwell was about the last of the great heroes. Frank Merriwell was a man who would never have, he would never have considered any such goings-on as, say, augment and are part of and drive most of our heroes of the TV shows of today. Oh, boy. A siree. No siree, Bob. Frank Merriwell, in case you're interested, and I presume some of you might be, the others are sitting out there with a sort of bland look, a tapioca look. Why do they allow tapioca in this world of ours? With all the technical advances we've made, why do we allow this stuff to still stick around? Why doesn't someone... I'd like to start tonight. I'd like to start tonight a telethon to raise some dough. To raise some dough to stomp out the stuff that we're really against in this world, most of us. And to augment the things that we're really for. About 6 months ago, when we were doing the all-night show out at Carteret, New Jersey, I think we touched upon what could very well be a rich motherlode of human yearning that lies just below the surface. And you know what it is? I really think it is, because I know it's within me. It's the desire to go completely to pieces. It is the desire to completely erode in style, and yet at the same time receive the plaudits of mankind in general. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, if a guy falls from the straight and narrow and he's hurled out of society, this is not a desirable situation for most of us. But wouldn't it be great to fall off the straight and narrow and not only remain part of society, but to be exalted in society? See, the further you fall off the straight and narrow, the higher you go up the scale. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it, though? This would be the perfect situation. Because underneath it all, I think almost all of us would like to stray just as far as we can stray from everything. And about 6 months ago, we started this campaign to raise dough to select from among us one person upon whom we would give all this bounty when we've raised, say, $1 million from among us. We give this one guy this $1 million with the instructions that all he has to do is to completely debilitate himself. All he has to do is to completely squander his whole life and $1 million, too. In other words, this man would be headed for downfall in style. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you like to see yourself sitting on the fantail of the Ile-de-France with $1 million in the checking account, and you got a spare pair of sunglasses ready for the Riviera, you know, and you got the dancing girls lined up down in the stateroom, and you got this great big tub of ice-cold 1929 champagne bubbling and hissing away in your veins, and you're ready, you know. You've been interviewed by John Daly. They're going to see you off. The whole country is watching your future career with anxiety because within you rests all their secret hopes and desires and dreams. Are you all set tonight? All right, tonight we're going to devote a larger portion of our show to what we call secret desires and dreams. So, don't stop, really. I mean, there's so much ahead. Look, it's great, it's great. It's September out. It's a wonderful night. Pleiades hangs over the horizon. The Big Dipper is out there. For you, but the Pleiades. The Big Dipper. Orion is out there, too, and Mars and Venus. And even poor Pluto, about which there is some doubt as to its parentage. All of these are for you to enjoy. For you to breathe and to see and to live. So come on, what are you doing sitting on your duff like this tonight? Look at me. It's all out there. It's all out there. You might come up with some great things. Like, say, for example, if you're walking past a chock full of nuts and you glance up and then there's this quick thought that goes through your mind, just an indefinable little thing, just and past it goes. You don't even really think it, you know. It's just a kind of a reaction. And there it goes down on paper. I imagine the average person would be really embarrassed. He'd be really astounded if he would see all these things down on paper and would read them back again to himself, say, 24 hours later. It's a terrible experience. And I can give you a little bit of an idea of how that sounds, or how it feels. I can't tell you how it sounds, but I can tell you how it feels. Several times I've had recordings of my shows made where I've had to listen to them played later on. And I remember one of the wildest experiences I ever had along this line. I was working a little Midwestern radio station, and it was a real potboiler. And it was one of these stations that, everybody is on the air 35 hours a day. And I was no exception to the rule. And I did a show that was on from about, I think, around 1:30 to 2:30, something like that. And one day it was recorded, for some reason or other. And I was hitchhiking someplace, you know. And I was hitchhiking, and a guy picked me up in his car. And I was sitting in the front seat of the car, and he had his radio on, and guess who he was listening to? Yeah. And I sat there. I didn't say anything. See, it was coming out of the radio, and this guy was just sitting there listening to this. I didn't say anything. And we went for about 5 miles. See, and I was waiting for him to say, enough of this clown, and cut it off. Or else he was going to say, isn't this guy great? Boy, this guy's great. He didn't say anything. He didn't say anything. That's what hurt me more than anything. He didn't say anything. We went 5 miles, see, and I kept kind of casting little hints. You know, I'd say, you know, when I'd listen to me say something, I'd go, oh, boy, I'd laugh. He didn't do anything. He didn't crack a smile, anything. We went 5 miles. He said, this is where I turn. And so I got out. That was a chastening experience. Chastening, chastening. What you do, you see, is you take this sour cream and you use it to baste. You know, speaking of the brief experience, well, maybe I better not yet. We'll save that to 12:30. Cocoon out there. You know, I wish I could use another word. There's a great Freudian word that describes it better than cocoon. You know the word, huh? Well, then we're in accord, eh, listener? Well, I just like to check once in a while to see how things are going in radio land. Okay, huh? Any interesting premiums lately on the backs of cereal boxes or anything, you know, in this fascinating world of yours? Nothing. You got that whizzeroo? A wazooka? I see. A wazooka. Well, what does the wazooka do, listener? You just sort of blow it out, huh? That reminds me of a thing they used to tell me in the Army all the time. Oh, those were the days. Yeah, like that great show, The Rome Affair. I was waiting for somebody to say that. You know? That would have been a great line, wouldn't it? I can hear this guy, you know, when the colonel comes in. He says it under his breath. The colonel says, I want to see you in my office in a minute, Rome. And he slams the door, see? And then Rome says under his breath. Right? How about that, huh? I'm in the wrong business, baby. Well, it's good to know that you're out there, listener. We've been worrying about you. We've had several phone calls from people who said, is the listener still with us? Uh-huh. Your only problem is now that you find yourself going to bed earlier and it's beginning to worry you. I see. Well, stick around, baby. We're with you. Hold on. You see, this is for the benefit of the uninitiated, and many of us are uninitiated. I tell you about the time I was in this initiation. I was in this fraternity, and they had an initiation. I maybe shouldn't tell you about it because I understand that if I ever divulge what happened in this initiation, there would be instant death meted out to me. But it was kind of funny. They had these candles, see? And they had this bucket of ox blood. You want to hear about the rest of this? And they had this bouquet of violets. Do you want to hear about that? Oh, no. No, this is from my callow youth period, as opposed to the period which I am now in, my callow adulthood. So stand up. Stand up and watch. Keep your eyes open. Above all, follow the bouncing ball. The thing to do is to learn to sing the lyrics. Hey, did any of you see the Saturday Review this week? There is a very funny thing in the Saturday Review this week. One of the reviewers, I believe his name is Alpert, Hollis Alpert, who does a lot of fine reviewing, incidentally, for the Review. He mostly reviews movies. Well, anyway, in the current issue, he is seen in an article whereby he is reviewing the movie War and Peace. And he's kind of needling it, see? He says it's nothing more nor less than a picture where they show a lot of little disjointed scenes. He says there's some great photography in it, but it's disjointed. He said most of the characterizations haven't been developed because they tried to put everybody in it, and they didn't have the time and one thing or another. But in general, his review was not what I would term a rave review. It was not a favorable review. However, right in the middle of the review, there is a small box. And the box says, Editor's Dissent. And the editor went on to say, we don't think Mr. Alpert is right in his review. I don't agree with it. Says, in fact, I think it's a great movie. And we don't want you to think that we think old Alpert is losing his bearings. No, sir, we still think he's a great reviewer, but we think he sure missed the boat on this one. Signed the editors. Which I thought was great. Can't you just see in the New York Times, right in the middle of a review, see, by Brooks Atkinson, there's a little square box. And it says, editor's note. It says, Mr. Atkinson is getting along in years, and he's been having a little trouble with sciatica lately. Now, this review occurred on the night that he went into the drugstore to order a new bottle of medicine, which he had run out of, and his sciatica was giving him a terrible time, and it was raining out, and they didn't have his medicine ready, and he had to go on to this show, and he was having a miserable time sitting there, and of course, naturally, the review really shows it. He gives it to him. Now, we're not trying to say that Mr. Atkinson isn't a great reviewer. He is, but you know how sciatica is. Signed the editor. Wouldn't that be terrific? But you see, there's no room for heroes anymore. Even editors. Even editors. Go sideways, young man. That's where the dough is. Go sideways, young man. Find Horace Greeley. Go south by southeast. Young man, there's real dough out there. Over there, near Hasbrook Heights. To be back on the air? Why? Our listener says, you know? And that's what I say, too. That's why all of us have vestigial gill covers, you know. There's been a lot of talk about that. The theory, of course, is that underneath it all, there is a possibility that someday you may need those vestigial gill covers, and they won't be vestigial at all. You'll be right back there. Wouldn't that be a wonderful idea, though, to sort of toy with, Yeah, that's a trouble with so many of us today. We have a little difficulty concerning ourselves, even momentarily, with what could be called an abstraction. There's nothing to do with buying a new Fig Newton 8, the new Dynashock transmission, with the new rocket belt drive, you know, the easily changed zip-up upholstering, all the rest of it. What we should do here for a minute is to talk about our eventual end. Where do you think you're going to end, old Abe, huh? How about you, Charlie? How about you, Max, Sam, Albert, Ethel? How about it, huh? Why don't we all go up to Fred's place, huh? That's a good place to end the night, eh? Go up to Fred's place and have a couple of games of pinochle, huh? That isn't exactly the kind of end I was talking about, however. Although, in many ways, that could be just as symbolic an end as all, as the eventual and the eternal. Yeah, there's much talk about this. The reason why people play games. You know, there's no other animal plays any game at all. Oh, no, that's not a game with a buddy. Any more than it's a game with you. Come on now, don't give me that. That's not a game. That is not a game. You're confusing. Well, again, I you know, women and children are still up. However, the animals do not play games as such. Now, when I speak of games, I'm talking about games that have rules. No, they don't. I refuse to accept that. They do not. All right, we're going to have to get in touch with you. Yeah. One bird will trip another bird. You're talking about starlings. Those aren't birds. What are you talking about? Oh, sure they will. I've seen starlings do that. Stick their foot out and trip another starling and laugh that lewd laugh. You know, when the other starling lands on his beak, gets up with, you know, the mud all over his eye. He talks out of the side of his bill. and then both of them go reeling off into the hedge looking for a buck to snipe. And then nothing greater than starlings, as far as I'm concerned. A couple of months ago, we told about the starling blight that hit Cincinnati, and if you're interested, I will now tell you about the starling blight. Do you want to hear the starling blight again? This is one of my favorite stories. Speaking of blights, this is WOR New York. We have records. Gene Shepherd here will be here till 1 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's now 10. But if you are interested in the starling blight, I want to find out whether or not anyone is out there truly interested in this starling thing. I've told the story several times, but it's still one of my favorites because it actually happened and it has so many symbolic repercussions, you know, a little like mirrors. If there's anybody out there who would like to hear the starling blight story again, now I am not asking. No, I don't want any phone calls. I'll have to ask our listener. Listener? Hey, listener. It's 10 o'clock. Come on, sit up. You want to hear about the starlings again? In Cincinnati? You heard about them, though. You want to hear about them again? Oh, come on. You're just being kind to me. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what happened. Cincinnati is in a strange geographical location. It isn't really part of the Middle West. It isn't part of the South. It isn't part of anything. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Cincinnatians are what they are. Pretty mad, usually. It's, you know, the old business of being an insider and an outsider. They're outsiders. They're not even part of anything. And that particular area has become a sort of Riviera for starlings. All the starlings in the world knock off a couple of months out of the year and lay over in Cincinnati. You know, like the guys in the money circle, they go down to Palm Beach, Miami, Key West. Once in a while, Cap d'Antibes, the Riviera. That's the Riviera of the starlings. Any starling who's worth his salt spends a couple of months hanging around the Garfield statue in Cincinnati. And so, eventually, you see, the word got out. The word began to spread. And it was a very funny thing. I was working in Cincinnati at the time it started. This is purely coincidental. I had no connection with starlings, by the way, and this is by way of a sort of, shall we say, a disclaimer. I have no vested interest in their world. However, I've become fascinated by their world. And it seemed that about 1949 or 50, a couple of promoter starlings came in off the main flyway route, which went down to Florida and up to Canada. A couple of promoters dropped in. They sat down in this little park, a little long, narrow park that isn't much more than a plot of grass, a few trees and a statue of Garfield. Old Garfield standing there in this park holding a big book up. And it looks like a Manhattan phone book. And he's got this big torch he's holding up, and his hat's on sideways. And underneath it is a little sign that says, Garfield, one of our great Ohio presidents. Well, a couple of these promoter starlings dropped by, and, you know, looked the scene over. And one of them dropped into the pool room there, cased the joint. The other one stood outside, sniped a few butts, and says, you know, buddy, looks like there might be dough here. It's a funny thing. This is relatively untouched. How about a subdivision? And so a couple of days later, they're back in the crowd, you know, with the starlings, and they begin to pass the word around. You know, you ought to drop into this joint, you know. It's a real fine place. They got real Italian food there. It's wonderful. And boy, such cigar butts. And you ought to sit on that statue of Garfield for a while. One of the most satisfying things I've seen in years. Great. And so you know how word of mouth goes. And a couple of months later, the first contingent of tourist starlings arrived with their lunches and their bottles of knee-high cream soda, you know, all the rest of it. And they began to litter the litoral with their leavings. And they began to sing their old songs, roister back and forth. And, yeah, they kind of liked it. The natives of Cincinnati at first liked it, too. That's the very tragic part of it all, you know. They began to throw them breadcrumbs. And once in a while, they put out a little snifter of brandy for them. Well, of course, this went over big with the birds. And the word continued to spread. Next season, the tourist crop was twice as large. At last count, which was in 1954, an average of 7.5 million starlings visited this tiny Garfield Park in the space of 24 hours alone. It was a tremendous thing. It was like Coney Island, multiplied by 10,000. And all these starlings acted just like they were at Coney Island. You could hear them hiccuping at 4 o'clock in the morning up in those trees. It was a disgusting thing. I can't tell you how disgusted I was. I used to finish my show at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there were this little row of trees, maybe 20 trees in a row, and they looked like great big taffy apples in the dark, just loaded with starlings. No leaves, just starlings. And all I could hear was this hiccuping. And once in a while, you'd hear other things which I can't even describe to you at this hour. I can't even bring it about to think about it. Well, that's the way the starlings happened in Cincinnati. And there was a guy who lived on the outskirts of Cincinnati who decided that there was dough in catching starlings because everybody was having trouble with them, so he invented the starling trap. And he put an ad in the paper. It said, "Starling trap, available to the city council." And how come the city council doesn't do something about it? Because the starlings are doing all that stuff to the hoods of your car. And look what they've done to the statue of Garfield, which is our pride and joy. And so they paid him $3,000 for this starling trap, which looked like a great big greenhouse sort of affair. And they set this thing out in Garfield Park, and everybody watched it. At the end of 3 weeks, there was one small lame pigeon who had been trapped by this starling trap, and not a single starling. At last reports, this guy was living in Tijuana riotously on his $3,000. He owned 2 thoroughbred horses and 2 small girls. It was a wonderful, wonderful story. So you see, out of the humblest of beginnings, within every cloud there's a silver lining. Within what even seems to be the greatest storm of the year, there will lie, indeed, the seed of a blossom. So keep your eye open, buddy. You too might be able to knock down 3 or 4 G's. You too, Mike. Surely you're interested. Hey, is there a red-blooded young American with us tonight? Red-blooded? Square-jawed? There must be. There must be 1 or 2. Yeasty, foamy blood, hissing, roaring, coursing through those veins. Rich, deep, passionate. So you see, keep your eye on the sparrow, buddy. Keep your eye on the starling. There's dough where you least expect it. Be ready when the time comes. Be ready to move fast. Don't allow them an instant. Stay one jump ahead of the crowd. Couldn't I love to teach a course in a university called "This Is How the World Is, Buddy"? No? Keep your eye on the sparrow, buddy. On the starling. There's dough in it. That's what happens when you try to shoot the rapids. Oh, there's a dream of glory. Hey, speaking of dreams of glory, one of our sponsors on this Sunday night debacle is the Linguaphone Organization. And I was talking to Mr. Sheriver, who is the president of the Linguaphone, and he speaks 17 languages. And like many people who speak all kinds of languages like that, they think in those languages.
That's right. What language? You think in English, don't you?
Well, of course you do.
Well, he thinks in 17 languages. And he used about 12 of them on me. When he was, you know, with a great big crowbar. But nevertheless, one of our sponsors is the Linguaphone Corporation, and they have one of the most successful records of any language school or any language course in teaching people how to actually speak the language involved. And they have the largest selection of languages of any school in the business today. Of course, some of their main languages, which we have talked about, conversational, French, Spanish, Hebrew. And by the way, they have two types of Spanish, the European and the south of the border Spanish, very important. Portuguese, Italian, German, Dutch, Russian, Polish, Czech, Norwegian, Swedish, Finnish, modern Greek, Irish, Esperanto. And then there are some pretty jazzy ones like Swahili, which incidentally I am learning. I haven't received my course. That's the reason I'm not able to speak with you tonight in Swahili. The course did not come through this week, although I do have a course in conversational French, which I'm going to begin using this week. And we'll try to put a little bit of it on the air. But the thing to remember about the Linguaphone system of learning languages is that you actually learn the conversation of the country involved, spoken by all sorts of different people. They don't have just one man speak it to you. They have all kinds and all types of dialects from that language and from that country. A very interesting way of learning it. And if you devote, according to their guarantees and so on, if you devote, say, 15 to 20 minutes a day to this thing, at the end of 3 months, you will be able to speak and write the language involved with the facility of a high school graduate of that country. Not a high school graduate of this country, but a high school graduate of, say, Spain, which is a pretty fair, facile knowledge of the language, I would say. And it takes about 3 months, and it's a lot of fun, too. It's the Linguaphone system, and they have... I could go on, but they have all kinds of methods of learning this thing, but it's all done at home, and it's done about 15 to 20 minutes a day. There's really not much more time involved than that. It takes a three-month period, and you're in business. Speak, read, and write the language. Now, if you'd like to find out about this thing, if you'd just like to get the information, they're not going to be banging on your door or anything. They'd just like to send you the booklet that tells about all the different languages that they teach. The one I'm taking just for kicks is Swahili and also French. Call Murray Hill 2-6800. You can call them now. That's Murray Hill 2-6800. The girls are on duty, and they'll take your name and they'll send off the booklet and so forth to you. And incidentally, when you do that, be sure to tell them what language you're particularly interested in, because apparently they have additional literature for specialized languages. Or, if you don't want to call, if you're living out of town and you'd prefer to write, you can write to me on a postcard, Gene Shepherd at WOR New York, and then I'll send it on to the Linguaphone people. That's Gene Shepherd, WOR New York. So, that's the Linguaphone thing, and we'll have a little more on it later on this evening. Here's a guy. I'm looking at some of the people who wrote in as a sort of, the endorsement thing. Have you ever endorsed anything in your life? I have never once written to, say, the Dutch Cleanser Company and say, Mr. Cleanser, I have used your Dutch Cleanser now 4 times on the wheel rims of my car, and all I got to say is it's great. I'm right out here in Spokane, Washington, and I'm sticking right with you guys. Signed, D.A. of Spokane, Washington. I have never done a thing like that. Did I ever tell you about the gag that was pulled on a friend of mine in radio out in Cincinnati? It was one of the most devastating gags I've ever heard of or seen or even could possibly imagine. Do you remember when this big patent medicine was very popular a couple of years ago? I will not give you the name. I will merely say that it started with H. Do you remember it? It turned out to have about 40% alcohol in it. And that's why all the grannies all over the country were were using this stuff after dinner, the ones who didn't believe in hard liquor. They like a thimble full of this health tonic. Once in a while, their old eyes would light up, and they'd sing snatches of songs from their early youth, tell ribald stories at the bridge club. You remember the stuff? Well, it doesn't make any difference. Anyway, there was a great big health tonic that got very popular, and they were taking out full-page ads all over in the New York Times, every place. And they were just ads, just loaded with these endorsements. Just loaded with them. Well, there was a guy doing a morning radio show in Cincinnati who was a very successful, very popular guy. But he was a very remote sort. And he had a tremendous, tremendous ego. Oh, he had a giant ego. He wore fawn-colored spats to bed. Anyway, this guy, he was sort of like the Adolf Manjou type. Well, somebody got a picture of him, a very big picture of him, and sent it off to this company with a beautiful letter. And remember, he did an early morning radio show. And a couple of days later, here comes the ad. Great big ad all over the country, and it shows this guy looking out of it. And underneath it, it said, "Every morning I had this terrible time getting up. I was having all this trouble with regularity. And my eyes began to glaze over from time to time. And I was always all the time bloated. And I had this awful time until I tried your wonderful tonic. 3 or 4 bottles, and look at me now. Spanking sharp. My rating has gone up 7% on my morning radio show. Sponsors are flocking. My fan mail has gone up 50%. And there it was all over the country. I got this trouble, you see. Right down here by my short rib. Oh, by the way, give them a call right now. Find out about the linguaphone course. Be the first in your neighborhood to learn Esperanto, Greek, conversational French. The number is Murray Hill 26800. Murray Hill 26800. Call them now. You know, speaking of the secret word, you never know where you're going to find a hero. And the heroics of a modern-day hero, as we pointed out, there's no real room for a Beowulf-type hero anymore. But the type of heroism, or heroism, if you prefer, that occasionally crops out in the 20th century world is worthy of note when it is encountered. Like this one night, I was sitting in a very stuffy living room in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And it was really a stuffy type living room, done in the traditional early American, which everybody in Bucks County affects. And I was sitting around playing Scrabble. It was one of those forced draft type Scrabble games. The living room was kind of hot. Nobody really wanted to play it. And everybody was very polite. And there was a woman with sort of bluish, silvery hair. Tall, thin woman. And she was very quiet and very polite. And I thought she was kind of stuffy. Like I said, you never know where heroism is going to pop up. You never know. Just keep your eye open. Keep it peeled.